Hi, it's Diane. Good to be back with you. On my mind this week, climate change. Scientists from around the world tell us we have only a few years, no more than 12, to try to avert the potentially catastrophic consequences of a warming planet. But what can we do? Climate scientist Jonathan Foley, executive director of Drawdown, explains the many substantive solutions that governments, businesses, and individuals can choose immediately to make a difference for our future. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us. Many of the world's leading climate scientists are painting a very dire picture of what's happening to our globe.
For decades now, scientists have been warning the world that we're changing the planet, period. We're causing the shift in our climate because we're releasing these so-called greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, other things into the air. That's trapping heat on our planet, which is warming it, and shifting weather patterns, our climate patterns, and even our ecosystems. And what's kind of sad is scientists have been telling the world this for decades and decades, and it seems like people really weren't listening. And the longer we wait to do anything about it, the bigger the problem is going to be and the harder it's going to be to change. So, yeah, scientists are getting more and more alarmed because this used to be out in the future, a little bit theoretical, you know, hey, we could avoid this if we just change course. But we didn't. And now we're starting to live in that future, and it's changing all around us.
And there is an indication that we have little more than 12 years to try to keep the planet from heating up beyond where we cannot return.
Scientists have written reports that say, yes, by, you know, the year 2030 is sort of an arbitrary deadline to say, you know, by that time, it's going to get really bad if you want to avoid the worst warming. But I don't like these artificial deadlines in some ways. I do want to have a sense of urgency, but not this kind of, oh, if we only miss it by, you know, 12 years in a day, then we might as well give up. That's not really true. Just the sooner we act, the more boldly we act, the less harm we're going to see. But this 12 years, this kind of, you know, a decade or so into the future timeframe, is meant to illustrate the sense of urgency that we really do need to kind of get off the dime and make some big changes fast.
Tell me what the greatest threats are if indeed the Earth does warm by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Well, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually is. When the planet warms a whole degree globally on average, it doesn't just mean like, oh, it's a 1 degree warmer where you live. It actually means a shift in global weather patterns. It means a shift in where ice can be and where it can't be. It means, you know, the snowpacks have to move up in elevation and so on and so on and so on. So while a degree doesn't sound like that big a deal, actually it is. And we've already warmed the planet about 1 degree from what it should be. You know, the Earth has a fever already of about a degree. We get to 1.5 degrees, and, you know, this planet will still look like the one we've all lived on for thousands of years. We get to 1.5 degrees and closer to 2 degrees, we start to enter a world that is geologically unknown to human civilization. It's a, you know, it's a very different planet than the one we've all lived on. And that means our coastlines would start to be different. Where glaciers are, how much ice is in the Arctic or Antarctic would change. Where deserts are, where rainforests are, things that are really important to us. Even more importantly, things like where we grow our crops or where the sea levels are near our major cities, where our water supplies come from. And the more warming we see, the more and more disrupted our world becomes. And that affects us in extremely profound ways. And of course, this is all happening on a world that's increasing in population at the same time, increasing in wealth, increasing in demands for food and water and raw materials. That's a dangerous combination.
So help me to understand what happened at the recent climate conference and what agreements they finally came to.
This last weekend, there's a conclusion of something what's called a COP, a C-O-P, which is just an acronym that means a conference of parties, which is kind of diplomat speak for a big meeting. And this is called COP 24. And as the name implies, there have been 24 of these bloody meetings. And they're kind of one after the other after the other. This latest one was actually in Poland, ironically in a coal-producing region of Poland, in a region that about 80% of its electricity is powered by coal, perhaps the dirtiest form of energy we have on the planet. And it was a follow-up to, as you indicated, a meeting we had in Paris a little while ago, which set out a reasonable kind of framework for the world's governments to agree to agree on how we might eventually deal with climate change. As you might take from my tone, I'm a little bit cynical about these meetings. We've had 24 of them, and most of what we can show for them is a big pile of paper. And I'm not sure the atmosphere has even noticed the meetings yet. Most of the progress we've seen on climate change on the ground in the real world has had little to do with the UN meeting frameworks. While we still need those, I actually think a lot of the most exciting action on climate change is not happening at the UN or even at the national levels. It's happening a lot in cities, in states, in corporations, in some countries all by themselves. Of course, we need the bigger international frameworks, but I'm also encouraged to see some action happening outside of it. Without all the diplomats, we just have people rolling up their sleeves and doing the work, and we need all of it.
On that note, tell me about your organization, Drawdown, and what are you trying to do?
Yeah, so I'm the director of this thing called Project Drawdown. I joined it about 2 months ago, and Drawdown, as the name implies, is really about changing course in how pollution is building up in the atmosphere. Right now, every year, the levels of these greenhouse pollutants that warm our planet are going up and up and up and up, and they've been doing so for over 100 years because of us. Drawdown says, wait a minute, sometime in the future, pollution levels have to stop, and they need to go back down again. We want to reverse this pollution. We want to not just stop climate change. We want to reverse it. So Project Drawdown is really the world's leading source for climate solutions. My colleague, Paul Hawken, who founded the organization, wrote a best-selling book, New York Times bestseller. It's selling well all over the world, called simply Drawdown, that outlines 100 different solutions that exist already out there in the world to combat and even reverse global warming. And it's the first time anybody had really put that all together. So Drawdown, even though we're facing a dire situation, Drawdown takes a tone not of just doom and gloom, but of kind of possibility and opportunity, saying we actually have all the tools we need to stop and reverse global warming. They're already out there. They already exist. And they're big enough. We already have the tools to solve climate change. We just have to get busy and deploy them and take them to scale and make them happen in the world. And our book and the website, drawdown.org, is really the first place to outline all of those solutions with real numbers behind them and share them with the world to get them out there as quickly as possible.
So what kind of criteria are you applying to these possible solutions?
In the book, Drawdown, which is out there now, and we'll be updating it again soon, we did an analysis of these 100 climate solutions where we looked very carefully at, you know, what is the latest science? What is the latest technology? What does the latest engineering say? As well as the economics. And we applied a bunch of models, kind of economic and technology models, to all of those scenarios, ran them through a computer, and asked, you know, given different scenarios, how much would this solution take out of the atmosphere? How much pollution could this solution prevent? And what would it cost? So all of the solutions are ranked in terms of a fancy unit called a gigaton, which is just a big number. It means a billion metric tons. So we measure the amount of pollution each solution would prevent in these billions of tons. And we measure it against kind of millions of dollars. And then we rank them from 1 to 100 in terms of, you know, how effective they might be. And what's interesting is a lot of the solutions are, you know, some of them are the ones you would expect. You see things like solar panels and windmills and electric cars and things like that. But a lot of them are things that most people kind of forgot about, like, oh, protecting forest, not burning down forests. That's a really good climate solution. Or, hey, agriculture is a big source of climate pollution. How about new forms of agriculture that use less pollution, or maybe not wasting so much food? That turns out to be a big climate solution. And then one of them that's really powerful that some people forgot about in a way in this conversation they should never have is about the human condition. It turns out empowering young women and girls in terms of their choices of reproduction and how many children they're going to have and when they have them. but also girls' education turn out to be some of the most powerful climate solutions because they steer not only the future levels of population in the world, and that drives a lot of our emissions and pollution levels.
Indeed.
But also, yeah, and also turns out when girls are running the economy and taking care of the land and taking care of households in more powerful ways, they tend to be more environmentally friendly and sustainable.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from environmental scientist Jonathan Foley.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Jonathan Foley, climate scientist with Drawdown. Now, one of the solutions at the top of your list is something called refrigerant management. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, the number one solution in the book is something a lot of people would never have thought about is exactly as you said, managing refrigerants. What that means is that a lot of the chemicals used in like refrigeration coils, compressors, the things that make up, you know, like air conditioners, even, you know, refrigerators in your kitchen, things like that, use very, very kind of nasty chemicals. Some of them are called halofluorocarbons, things like that. And we changed all those a long time ago to prevent damage to the ozone layer, which is an entirely separate problem in the atmosphere. And we've replaced them with chemicals that don't harm the ozone layer, but it turns out if they leak out into the air, they end up being an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas. They trap a lot of heat, molecule for molecule, much more than carbon dioxide even does. So even small little leaks of these refrigerants getting into the atmosphere can have a powerful heat-trapping effect. So while we need to look at carbon dioxide coming from burning coal and oil and gas and all that kind of stuff, absolutely, there turn out to be other greenhouse gases, including these halofluorocarbons or other fluorinated gases, we call them, but also things like methane, another gas called nitrous oxide that comes out of agricultural soils. So it turns out when you look across the whole suite of solutions, yeah, refrigerants are important, our food system's important, empowering girls is important. All of those are in the top 10 of the world's climate solutions, and they're not getting enough attention. And that's one of the things we do.
Tell me how much food we are wasting.
Oh, gosh. This is like the dumbest environmental problem of all because, you know, there's no benefit to anybody from doing this. But yeah, it turns out about 30, 40 something percent of all the food grown in the world is never eaten by anybody. And that's that number is kind of interesting because it's basically true in countries like the United States because consumers, you know, people like you and me, end up throwing a lot of food away in our homes, our restaurants, the cafeterias we use, and so on, but also around us, like in grocery stores, in the kitchens of the places we go and eat. But in poor countries, there's also a lot of food waste, maybe 30, 40% as well, but it happens closer to the farm. It's because what's grown maybe never even got to the marketplace because it got stranded on the road somewhere or get eaten by insects or rats or something.
But how does that actually affect climate change?
Well, think about it for a second. If 40% of all the food grown in the world is never eaten, that means also 40% of all the resources it took to grow that food, 40% of all the land, 40% of all the fertilizers, all the energy, all the water, all the ecosystems that are affected are also kind of wasted. So if you could stop food waste, you can then eventually prevent a lot of these other upstream environmental issues. That means 40% less land that needs to be cleared, 40% less fertilizer that's being wasted, some of which causing greenhouse gas emissions. Other of that goes into the water and pollutes it.
You talk also about plant-rich diets.
Yes. A plant-rich diet is what we're saying is, you know, basically The flip side of that coin is to say, well, eating a little less meat. We're not saying the world all has to become 100% vegan tomorrow or something like that. But if we could just curtail our appetite for especially red meat, just even a little bit, and bring it back to maybe, you know, a few less servings and a little bit more plant-based protein, that would be a huge impact on not only climate change, but also on other big environmental issues. Because meat consumes far more resources than any other kind of food you can imagine. So again, like food waste and our diets, which are things you and I can do a lot about, actually are some of the biggest climate solutions of all.
You talk also about something called silvopasture. What does that entail?
Well, silvopasture is basically it's a kind of way of raising animals in, a, as the name implies, kind of a pasturing system with trees. Kind of working with natural ecosystems where you can tuck away more carbon in the trees and the landscape and the soils and so on. So there are cases where you can raise animals for meat or dairy that actually could be regenerative, that could actually help restore the land. Unfortunately, a lot of the way we graze animals and raise them today is actually pretty destructive, but it doesn't have to be. Silvopasture is one of those ways you could do that better. There's other kind of modes of like what we might call holistic grazing, where you could kind of graze animals in a more gentle way in the landscape and actually rebuild the soils and rebuild ecosystems. And that holds quite a bit of promise as well.
Jonathan, I'm wondering about what kinds of responses you've had, considering that you really are suggesting people make substantive changes, not only to the way we grow food, but what kinds of food we eat and how we manage that overabundance of food that too many of us find on our plates at home and in restaurants.
Well, what's kind of interesting is the overall reception to Drawdown has been incredibly positive. As I mentioned, it's a best-selling book. It's one of the best-selling environmental books of the last decades. It's incredibly popular, probably because we're not preaching. We're just saying, hey, here's the math. Here are solutions. And by the way, all of these are good for us. Reducing food waste saves us money. It saves landfills from filling up. It saves resources that could be used elsewhere. It helps, it helps farmers. It helps feed the poor. It helps you and your bottom line and your checkbook. Nobody loses from taking care of food waste. Also, eating a little less meat. We're not saying, oh, everybody has to become vegan tomorrow because I said so. No, we're just saying, hey, we could all maybe shift a little bit. And by the way, your doctors are telling you the same thing, too. And we're not wagging our fingers at anybody saying, thou shalt do this or you're bad. No, we're just saying, hey, let's invite you to consider the opportunity, the possibility of doing things a little bit differently in ways that are already beneficial to you.
So what countries around the world do you see acting on these recommendations, doing perhaps taking the lead in following these ideas?
Well, I think you see different solutions to climate change being played out in different parts of the world. Even though there is some bad news, emissions, the kind of pollution going into the air, are ticking up again, even though they looked like they were stabilizing for a while. Now, in the last year or two, it seems like they're maybe rising again. That's very disconcerting, but there are very positive signs somewhere here and there around the world. Of course, some of the European countries, the Western Europe, the Scandinavian countries have been lowering their pollution levels for a couple decades now. The United States, our emissions have been going down since 2007, even though the economy has grown considerably since then. California, now we're not a separate country yet, but you know who knows, is the fifth largest economy in the world. And Jerry Brown just committed us to not only having a completely carbon neutral electricity system, he actually signed an executive order saying the entire California economy had to be carbon neutral in the 2040s. And with Gavin Newsom becoming our next governor, I think we're going to see some real action on that. So we're seeing a lot of stuff happening in different places, not just at the federal level, but we're seeing it in states and cities and lots of good things.
And what about the lack of leadership at the federal level with Donald Trump saying he does not believe that humans are causing climate change and not participating in the Paris Agreement? Mm-hmm. I mean, what effect negatively or positively do you see the U.S. participation?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, the planet doesn't really give a damn what Donald Trump believes or doesn't believe. the physics doesn't care. So climate change isn't about belief. It's about evidence and the laws of physics. So he can believe whatever he wants. The atmosphere is going to do whatever it's going to do. It is unfortunate, though, to see the U.S. Federal government stepping away from commitments. More disconcerting, of course, is that federal scientists are being intimidated and being censored and muzzled deliberately by the heads of agencies who seem to be their job is to not support the agencies they run, but to destroy them. So we just saw the Department of Interior, the former head of the EPA, and so on. It's very disconcerting to see science being censored by politicians, and nobody should be in favor of that. And that's just dangerous for democracy, regardless of your partisan inclinations. Nobody should be muzzling scientists and telling them what not to say, like telling your doctor they can't tell you the truth. That's not a good idea. So that's very, very disconcerting. But there is still incredible leadership in the United States on climate change, but it's happening at states level or cities or corporations or NGOs, far more than half of the U.S. economy, regardless of what Trump says or not, is going to abide by the Paris Accords. Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York and so on, has organized massive responses, an effort called We Are Still In. Even if the U.S. federal government says, nah, we're not going to do Paris, guess what? The United States is still going to follow the Paris Accords anyway, because so much of the emissions happen at the state and city level or corporate level. So it's unfortunate what's happening with the federal government, but I think the U.S. will still make progress. But it's going to slow down, and we're going to miss opportunities, and we're going to really erode the quality and veracity of our scientific contributions to the world. And that is a terrible legacy of any president.
So finally, where do you think we're going to be 12 years from now?
Well, you know, it's hard to wake up every morning and be always optimistic in this business. But you know what? I'm hopeful. But I use the word hope very deliberately, because hope to me is a verb. It's not a noun. It means to get up in the morning and you do your best. You stare a problem in the eye, knowing you may actually fail, but you do it anyway. And we need a lot of that kind of hope right now. We need courage. We need hope. And we need work. So sitting around wringing our hands saying the sky is falling is not helpful. We need to get up and do the work. And I'm reminded that, you know, almost everything I was told as a kid was impossible ended up not only being possible, but inevitable, like the end of the Cold War or legalizing gay marriage or an African-American president, the end of apartheid and so on. Nobody in the 70s or 80s would have said any of those things were possible, but they did happen anyway. So when people tell me now, like, oh, we can't solve climate change, we won't be able to figure it out, I'm like, yeah, we can. Mm. We have all the tools we need. We have everything we need to do. And the only reason we'll end up in a doomy and gloomy world is if we just choose that world. If we just by default do nothing, we've made a choice. And that's a bad choice. We can make a different choice. And all of that power is sitting right in our hands today. And that's what I want to do today, tomorrow, into the next decade. And hope others will join us.
Jonathan Foley, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for the chance to speak to you today. It's a delight.
And that's it for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8850, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. Today's show was produced by Sandra Baker, Becca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Uroglivker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.